We proceed to the next case, which would be Linda Killingsworth v. Household Bank. Mr. Edelman.
May it please the Court, Counsel. In August 2004, Ms. Killingsworth was sent an offer of credit that violated the disclosure requirements of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Whatever was required to create a cause of action existed in August 2004. December 1, 2004 was the effective date of the amendment repealing the private right of action for disclosure violations. Suit was filed afterwards in 2005. That sequence of events is absolutely identical to that before the court in Murray v. GMAC Mortgage. In that case, Judge Easterbrook held that the repeal took effect December 1, 2004 with respect to conduct that occurs after that date, substantive disclosures made after that date, even though suit is not filed until, in that case, March of 2005.
Now, in this case, all that was done, just so I'm clear, was the, I'll call it a solicitation.
Yes.
And that was received.
That is correct, in August 2004.
And that was it?
That was it. It did not contain a clear and conspicuous disclosure of the right to opt out.
And she didn't do anything. It's just that. And I'm not being cynical here, but we all get stuff in the mail, solicitations that usually go in a wastebasket. Maybe we're throwing things away that could be a viable complaint. But that's really what we have. I'm not going to go to the merits of all of that, but I just want to clarify, that's it.
That's it.
And you're saying that accrued at the time she received it, I guess?
The cause of action is they obtained credit information. They have to make a firm offer of credit. It must contain or be accompanied by clear and conspicuous disclosures of the right to opt out. All that was completed by August 2004. That was it. Last act necessary to avoid liability occurred August 2004.
And the accrual of the adverse action, I guess, was when they assessed her credit report somehow or other.
This is not an adverse action case, unlike the last case.
What would it be, though? Isn't that what we're talking about? They used her credit report in order to solicit?
Yes. But the adverse action is a different one. If they use your credit report to take an adverse action, certain disclosures must be made. But that is in a transaction initiated by the consumer. In most cases, you cannot use credit information except in connection with the transaction that the consumer initiates. One exception is the firm offer of credit exception. A merchant, such as HSBC, may pull credit information for the purpose of solicitation, even though this consumer has not sought to do business with HSBC in any way, shape, or form, if they make a firm offer of credit and they provide the prescribed disclosures. They have to do two things. We contend they did not make the prescribed disclosures, and this offer was sent with the defective disclosures August 2004, and that's it. That's the existence of the cause of action.
And what should they have said? I know they had stuff in small print, but that wasn't enough, apparently.
That is correct. At the time, the requirement was that there be a clear and conspicuous disclosure of the right to opt out. And our point is that including the disclosures on the 11th of 12 pages of the inserted card member agreement is not a clear and conspicuous disclosure of a right that is possessed not by somebody who wants to enter into the card member agreement, but the right of someone who does not wish to have their credit pulled and does not wish to enter into a card member agreement to stop the further use of credit information. Now, matter was addressed in Murray, and there Judge Easterbrook squarely says that recent amendment to the Act abolishes private remedies for violations of the clear disclosure requirement, which in the future will be enforced administratively, but that change does not apply to offers made before its effective date and thus does not affect its litigation. So what he focused in was when the offer was made. That is August 2004 in this case.
They call that dicta, but I guess you can...
Well, actually, I don't think it is dicta. In GMAC, the defendant moves for a hearing based on this argument, and it was absolutely material to the disposition of the case. The court remanded for instructions that we proceed to determine whether a class action should be certified. If, in fact, the complaint should have been dismissed, it wouldn't have done that. It would make no sense to do that. It would have simply disposed of the entire case. It's also, I think, compelled by the plain language of this provision. 1681 MH8, which affected the repeal, says it, quote, shall not apply to any failure by any person to comply with this section, close quote. Unlike the cases that the defendant relies on, it doesn't say that it will apply to certain pending cases but not others. It looks to the substantive conduct. And the date, 12-104, was set by congressional directive to the agencies, the Federal Reserve Board and the FTC. The setting of a future effective date necessarily implies that the law applicable until that date is the existing law. You can only have one effective date. And it also makes sense in this context because Congress, in facto, also changed the substantive disclosure requirement. Before, at the time of Cole and at the time of this mailer, it simply had to be clear and conspicuous. Now, under FACTA, the Federal Trade Commission prescribes what the disclosure is. And that is why current mailers have this big box on the first page. It has to be the principal promotional page that comes out when you open the envelope. It has to be a certain size. It's precisely prescribed. So right now, there are no determining whether somebody complies with that imposes no enforcement burden at all. It's either you open it, and it's either there, and it pops out, or it isn't. And that was issued by regulation, which took effect at the end of January 05. The rulemaking was still going on, and it became mandatory at the beginning of August 05.
So if it were in this mailing that your client received, that would have been open and shut. It wouldn't have been a problem.
Absolutely. So
are we holding to too high a standard before the effective date?
Absolutely not, because clear and conspicuous, as was pointed out in the Cole case, is a staple of commercial law. Whatever satisfies it, putting something on the 11th of 12 pages without a heading that is card member agreement, that doesn't really identify what this provision is. It's wedged in between two other disclosures, which are pertinent only if you enter into the card member agreement. Whatever clear and conspicuous means, this doesn't qualify.
So you don't think most unsolicited mailings get to page 11, huh?
The disclosure is for somebody who doesn't want to enter into the agreement. If somebody doesn't want to enter the agreement, they're not going to start on page one, go through, it's actually 15 pages. There's a couple of pages of literature plus the card member agreement. And that's what the FTC's solution was fairly obvious. You put it on page one, you put it on the page that comes out when you open the mailer, and it is open and shut. You could almost computerize the process. It doesn't require extensive litigation, so that the amount of enforcement resources devoted to this is basically nil. A lot of the case law has been addressed in the prior cases, and I'd like to save some time for rebuttal. Whether this is retroactive was addressed at length in the Bonner case, in the Shellman case, in the Panko case, which just came out and we submitted with a Rule 28 letter, attributing, and the cases hold that where you have a completed act, it had certain legal consequences, including a private right of action, abolishing that is retroactive. There is no clear directive from Congress to apply the statute retroactively. The court in Murray said it was not to be, and I simply ask that the court apply Murray to this case. And I'll save the remainder of my time unless one of your honors has some questions.
Okay. Mr. Hockman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Let me just begin with Murray. As Your Honor pointed out, we do believe that that was dicta. And I think the most obvious way to make that point is to simply point out that the question of Section 312F and whether that expresses a clear congressional intent to bar private rights of action as of the date of enactment wasn't presented, wasn't considered, wasn't discussed, was not even remotely before the court. And in fact, it wasn't necessary for the court to reach the question of retroactivity in Murray for the disposition of the 23F appeal in that case. The only question in that case was whether there should be class certification, it should be allowed to go forward. And of course, a court can decide the question of class certification, has authority to decide whether the question of whether class certification is appropriate, even as it's considering whether the claim fails as a matter of law.
But we have to make that decision today, one way or the other, right?
Exactly. And let me turn to Section 312F, where I want to begin. In Section 312F, Congress has spoken to the temporal scope of the bar on private suits. It drew the line at the date of the FACT Act's enactment. Section 312F states, liabilities existing on the date of enactment survives. Killingsworth reads the provision to mean nothing. She believes that all claims based on liabilities arising prior to the necessarily later effective date established by regulators survived. If that were correct, 312F would be entirely unnecessary. Perry has decided the question that that Killingsworth's put forward with respect to 312F, whether 312F preserves the claim in and of itself on a going forward basis. Perry says no. Put simply, there were only two possible interpretations of this provision. Either their interpretation, that their claims and future claims under section asserting violations of section 1681 MD survive, or our interpretation that this was the place where Congress chose to address the temporal scope of the bar on private suits. Perry having rejected their choice, our choice is the only one remaining. Judge Sykes asked in the previous argument whether there's anything left for section 312 for the regulators to do under our reading of section 312F, and indeed there is. And I think the prior attorney for Esurance made the point. The FACTA adopted a number of additional regulatory provisions, none of which are at issue in this case. This case and the previous case both concern pre-existing regulatory disclosure requirements. But, for instance, in Section 1681MH, the very provision in which the bar on private suits is found, a new risk-based pricing notice, and it's not material to get into what it is, but it's a new disclosure requirement, is imposed on creditors. And as a result, Congress made the decision to kick to the regulators the authority to determine the effective date of those new regulatory requirements. That was an entirely appropriate judgment, and in fact, it's perfectly sensible that Congress, who drew the policy that private litigation is no longer the mechanism for resolving these kinds of disputes, that in fact public enforcement is better, Congress should choose in Section 312F when to cut off private litigation, but the regulators who are expert and work with industry and have an understanding of how these disclosures should be packaged and developed would be able to determine when those substantive regulatory requirements would take effect.
So your argument is that other subsection is subject to the administratively established effective date, but the repeal of the private right of action is effective on the date of enactment.
Right, and under Landgraf, because Section 312F is specifically addressed to that question, to that portion of the new statute that affects liabilities asserted in court, that 312F basically speaks to that, and Congress has made a decision with respect to that. As to the substantive liabilities, Congress has said the regulatory effective date applies with respect to those new disclosure requirements. I could spend a little bit of time going over the alternative argument for retroactivity, and I just want to briefly run through that. The basic point is that it doesn't make much sense here to apply the presumption against retroactivity, because the presumption against retroactivity is based on a concern, reflects a concern about upsetting expectations of the party whose conduct has been legally challenged. What's odd about Killingsworth's retroactivity claim is that it makes no sense to talk about her expectations with respect to the conduct giving rise to the suit. She is a mere passive recipient of a letter, as Judge Mannion pointed out earlier, and so she didn't even make a decision to receive the letter. She took no action in reliance on the pre-existing legal regime. And so, and for all the reasons we stated in our brief as well, we don't think that the retroactivity analysis actually fits with the nature of her claim. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about issues the district court did not decide, and specifically why, under this court's decision in Cole, we would be entitled to affirmance of the judgment, even if the court doesn't get into the retroactivity issues. Because even if Killingsworth has the right to assert her claim, it fails as a matter of law, because HSBC's disclosure was, in fact, clear and conspicuous under the appropriate standard. In Cole, this court recognized, first, that the question whether a disclosure under the FCRA is clear and conspicuous is a matter of law. So the fact that the district court did not decide it doesn't prevent this court from reviewing it as a matter of law. And, in fact, it was properly preserved below, so this court has the authority to reach it. Cole also said that the Truth in Lending Act standard for clear and conspicuous informs the FCRA standard, and that makes sense because the single solicitation often contains disclosures required by both the Truth in Lending Act and the FCRA, and as a result, it makes sense to harmonize the two regulatory regimes. The official staff commentary to Regulation Z under the Truth in Lending Act, which we cite in our brief, makes clear that all is required is that a disclosure be in a reasonably understandable form. And this is what's critical. The regulation is specific that the disclosure need not be located in any particular place and that disclosure need not be segregated from other material. What Killingsworth is saying and what you heard this morning is that the problem with the disclosure is that it's included with the card member agreement, which just means it hasn't been segregated from other material, and that it was put on page 11 rather than page 1, which is an effort to argue that it belongs in a specific place. The clear and conspicuous standard is not the demanding standard for credit disclosures that the plaintiffs are making it out to be. The demanding standard is the one that was more recently adopted. Namely, the new standard, and the name is the simple and easy to understand standard. And that is where Congress made a decision to heighten the requirement for this particular disclosure. Plaintiff admits that that heightened requirement doesn't apply here. And so plaintiff is, in effect, attempting to drag back in time a disclosure requirement that she admits doesn't apply in this case. And in fact, what you find in that new disclosure requirement is a requirement to put, in short form at least, the opt-out disclosure at issue here on the very front page. It cannot be the case, especially since the commentary to the regulations that implemented the simple and easy to understand requirement make clear that that is beyond pre-existing law. The regulators consciously chose to go beyond pre-existing law in this respect.
Without regard to the actual merits and the details of whether it was any, you know, what kind of a solicitation it was, I look more at the accrual date of when this time having these private right of action, what occurred? They said there's one occurrence here. Basically, she received it, and I guess they apparently used her credit report in order to prepare this solicitation. Now, that apparently is what occurred, and on page 11, I guess it says, in what you think is enough, saying, yeah, we used it. But as of that date, at least, this is a private right of action, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no dispute in this case, unlike the prior case, regarding the accrual date, because the notice at issue here, the disclosure issue here is, as counsel pointed out, is just that what's called the opt-out disclosure, the opportunity to write into credit reporting agencies and tell them not to release your credit information for the purpose of sending solicitations just like this. And as soon as she receives a solicitation with an actually defective notice, her cause of action would have accrued, and we haven't disputed that here.
That's because the statute provides for nominal damages? Is
correct.
That the basis for that?
There's statutory damages in these cases. But as I just pointed out, we do think it's absolutely clear on this record, in light of the standard under the Truth in Lending Act, that our disclosure is adequate. And in fact, our disclosure included boldface type. And under the regulations under the Truth in Lending Act, the boldface type is not required for clear and conspicuous disclosures. It's required for a heightened, or it satisfies a heightened requirement of more conspicuous disclosures. The final point, I see my time is up, so I'll go ahead and...
Rapp would give you a sentence.
Well, just the quick final point I wanted to make is that even if, for any reason at all, this disclosure is found inadequate, we also believe that there's no conceivable argument that any violation here was willful. The worst that can be said is that the standards here are flexible and that, as a matter of a post hoc judgment, a court would have decided that the standard here wasn't satisfied. But the standard of willfulness, to satisfy willfulness, which is an essential element of the claim they have asserted, requires us to have knowledge. And under the circumstances, at most, all we could have known is that there was a risk that a court might have, looking back, reached that conclusion.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
You've got one minute, Mr. Edelman.
Willfulness, Your Honor, is a question of fact not determinable in the pleadings. With respect to 312F, this is not the kind of clear statement that is required under Landgraf to have retroactivity. It says that nothing in any provision of this Act shall be construed to affect any liability under Section 616 or 617 of the FCRA that existed on the day before the date of enactment of this Act. What counsel infers is a negative pregnant, namely that any liability that exists on the date of enactment or later is affected. But a negative pregnant is not a clear statement, nor is it correct. It can have lots of, Section 312F can have lots of effect. For example, the agency is directed to do various things, including establish an effective date. It cannot do anything to affect any liability that exists now. Makes perfect sense and has force, even if the statute, as held in Murray, took effect on 12-1-04. I see my time is up, unless Your Honors have some questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
In this case, it will be taken under advisement.